It's Friday, October 8th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Mi Maria, 4 years after a hurricane devastated Puerto Rico, a new oral history collection documents how the island has persevered. Then, tough questions, celebrating the freedom to write, free speech on campus, and a Facebook whistleblower. We put the toughest questions about free speech to Pen America CEO Suzanne Nossel. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. Mi Maria, Surviving the Storm, tells 17 stories of the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. In 2017, that storm pummeled Puerto Rico and raised to the surface issues of colonialism and community. Mi Maria is the latest book in the oral history series from Voice of Witness, a human rights storytelling nonprofit that amplifies the voices of people impacted by and fighting against injustice. Joining me now, the book's co-editor, Risha Chansky, and one of the project's narrators, Sarah Arvelo Alicea, and she's a special featured curriculum specialist for this project as well. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us here.
It's such a pleasure. So Risha, let me start with you. What was the genesis of this project?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Stephen. When Hurricane Maria made landfall in the Puerto Rican archipelago on September 20, 2017, it really left no part of the land unscathed. The hurricane triggered floods, it triggered mudslides, it washed out roads, destroying tens of thousands of homes, farms, and businesses. It caused the largest blackout in U.S. history and the second largest in the world. It led to widespread shortages in food and drinking water and gasoline, and it was ultimately responsible for thousands of deaths. On October 30, just 5 weeks after the hurricane, we started our courses at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez, where I teach. We started those courses again. And we understood that the reason why a university or an organization opens after a disaster of that magnitude is to provide a sense of security, place, and community, both for the students who are matriculated at the university, but also for the community surrounding the university. While we were at the university, we mostly had electricity from generators. Sometimes we had water, and sometimes we even had internet. When we as teachers returned to the classroom, we realized pretty quickly that in our programs, we hadn't received any training on what to do in the aftermath of a disaster. We only knew that we were the people who had to show up. And so when we returned to the classroom, I was struggling to find something for my students to do that would not only help them bridge back to the lessons that we were mandated to teach, but also something that would support them in their lives and in their experiences, knowing that those experiences were ones that they didn't leave at the door when they entered the classroom. My area of specialty is autobiography studies. And so that means that I study the ways in which people narrate the stories of their own lives. So it seemed very logical to me that I would ask the students to say, do you want to tell part of your hurricane story? I made this a voluntary assignment. There were no grades given out. And I was extremely surprised when every single student, most of them with pen or pencil on paper, because it would be long months until we had electricity again, 100 students turned in these hurricane memoirs for me. This was an extremely shocking experience. I heard the story, for example, of Gabrielle, who sat holding his grandmother for hours as the roof of their home was taken by the hurricane and their possessions flew out after it. Again and again, the words screaming and crying were repeated in these narratives. I finally came to Alejandra's narrative, and Alejandra told me that the saddest part of her life was watching her neighbors dig two graves in their backyard because family members had died due to the ongoing lack of electricity and the fact that the hospital in their town of Aguadilla remained closed. So these two family members could not receive the routine medical care that they needed to stay alive. After reading that narrative, and I read these narratives by candlelight because it would be 96 days before my own electricity was restored. After reading these, I decided I wanted to do something to help my students who felt so disempowered and so out of place from the hurricane. I wasn't quite sure what that would be at the time, but I was doing work in a cafe on the plaza in our town because that cafe very nicely had a generator, a mobile hotspot, and did not mind if we camped out there for hours turning it into our offices. One of the first emails that I received during that time period was an email blast from Voice of Witness, a nonprofit organization that believes that by amplifying human stories, we can create social justice. They were having an open call to propose books for their series, which is published by Haymarket Books. In between, and I'm going to say explosions, because what happens when we try to connect neighborhoods to the electric grid, if there's a problem, there's an explosion and the entire grid goes down. So working through explosions for several days, I managed to write up a proposal for the Voice of Witness program. And gratefully, I was accepted into that program.
Wow.
With one of my lots of explosions, wow. With one of my with another faculty member and friend in my department, Jocelyn Haliga Vargas, we offered four sections of an oral history for social justice course in which we ethically train students to collect, transcribe, translate, edit, and disseminate oral histories of the hurricane. We came up with a body of approximately 100 oral histories that were generated by those courses. My co-editor, Marcy Denisak, and I at the same time were crisscrossing the Puerto Rican archipelago to collect additional stories from one of the students in their memoir described Puerto Rico as post-apocalyptic after the bomb went off. And that's the landscape that Marcy and I were traversing to collect additional narratives. So the genesis of this project, and I'm sorry, I seem to have given a very long answer to your question, but the genesis of this project was looking around and seeing students feeling so helpless, being part of our communities, helping to put roofs back on houses, helping to cook communal meals for 20 and 30 people. We knew we had to do something. And being dorky English teachers, this is the way that we felt as though we could best help.
Well, I like that approach. I mean, as lovers of dorky English teachers here at Pan America, that's our MO. Sarah, I mean, I wonder, you of course contributed to this volume, and I want to talk about your contribution in a moment, but maybe you can tell me first, I mean, you know, we move in this moment where the news cycle changes every hour. I mean, Maria came through, you know, 4 years ago now. Just help us. I mean, from where Risha has sort of left off, you know, explain to us how the last few years have been among Puerto Rico's communities as a result of the storm. How has the storm continued to have an impact?
Well, I can tell you a little bit of my story as a way to understand the larger narrative, right? Mm-hmm. And in my case, in 2017, my husband and I were left completely homeless. We lost every single piece of personal property we owned in an unprecedented flooding. And we lived at that time, we rented in an area where we were not surrounded by any major body of water. So of course, it taught us not only about the effects of heavy precipitation being brought forth now, but these newer storms we are seeing in the Caribbean and we are seeing around the world thanks to climate change. But it also showed us how alone we were. And I believe that feeling is echoed through the voices of pretty much any U.S. citizen who lives in Puerto Rico and has gone through the many hardships that we have experienced since 2017. So not only did we lose everything, not only did we have to live with strangers for several days who fed us, who allowed us to use their bathroom, although there was no running water. Not only were we collecting buckets of water every day and sleeping on the floor, but after that, we started making our journey to a family member's house. But that, of course, meant they were minors. And I am certain there were many communities that were facing the same struggles. None of us had running water or water that was safe for us to drink. Many people suffered not only stomach problems, they also suffered skin problems. And this is, of course, the aftermath. So many people would believe the hurricane happened on that date and stayed on that date. It was something that lasted weeks, months, and we still feel today. After the hurricane and still today, we are suffering rolling blackouts, and this is constant. I am connecting with you today because we have solar power. This is the only certainty I have that my power will not go off as I am speaking with you, Stephen, and with Risha, and the many people who are listening to us. In addition to an unstable electric grid, our water system remains as unreliable as it was back then. We have big droughts that have happened between 2017 and right now, and nothing is being done by the appropriate authorities or the groups that should be handling that, meaning that there are months when we don't have water, when we are rationing water for our different towns and areas, but there are times when the authorities empty or lower lake levels because they fear what that may do to the dams. They fear collapses in different areas. So there's an excess of water, but a lack of water at the same time because nothing is happening with these essential resources that everyone needs to live and to thrive in a place that it's labeled a U.S. territory. So we're speaking about American citizens who do not have stable access to water or electricity. And this is exacerbated by many other issues we have had. Starting in 2019, we suffered a swarm of earthquakes, meaning people were told that they needed to be in a safe location. But many of them, because of our high poverty level and what happened after Maria, didn't have a stable home to be in. Many people were sleeping on the streets, fearing for their lives while still recuperating from the trauma of the hurricane. And as it's common knowledge to all of us, then the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And we are telling people again to wash their hands consistently, to go back to a space where they feel safe, to do remote teaching and learning. And these are the same families and the same children that can't have access to water, to internet, to electricity, or to a roof where they remain dry after it rains. So it's certainly a big picture of one disaster after the other. And of course, that discrepancy between what nature cost versus all of these important disasters, that if we look at them from a lens of colonialism, they're really human-made disasters. So that's some of what has happened from 2017 till today. And bringing it back to my story, as an example, I am in the process right now of building a home, and I'm staying at a family member's house. And this is someone who's a professional, whose husband also has a job, who you could say are a stable family, not an extreme low socioeconomic status family.
Wow. I mean, obviously I asked you a big question, and for you to be able to, so I think, eloquently describe what these 4 years have been like, these sort of rolling crises for Puerto Rico, so illustrative. And I think that comes out in this text. I wonder, Risha, you know, it seems like what Sarah has just shared, I mean, this seems like one of these narratives that hasn't been told about Puerto Rico, or the ones that aren't there. That's not the same one as you hear from U.S. government officials or from the media. How do you think that this project is going to advance more holistic storytelling about Puerto Rico and the U.S. citizens who live there?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you asked that question, Stephen. And thank you, Syra, for so eloquently setting up my answer to that. I want to answer this question in two ways. I want to answer it in a macro way and in a micro way. And so I'm going to start with the collection as a whole and projects like this, not just our project, but other projects that are trying to do the same work. And then I'll work into some of the personal narratives in the book that illustrate my point. What I want to say is that institutionalized colonial practices and systemic racism prevent members of marginalized communities who are often on the front lines of the climate crisis and environmental degradation from participating in larger conversations about halting the climate crisis. Ideations of and judgments about experiential knowledges and who has the right to tell a story, who has the right to contribute knowledge when making these changes, limit participation from the very people who are eyewitnesses and therefore have essential knowledge of disaster and climate change. We have used the body of 100 collected oral histories to contribute to a solar microgrid project in which researchers at Brown wanted to know, how did the electricity go out? How was the electricity restored? And what were people's personal needs? We've contributed to another project on urban planning and sustainable building, in which, again, the narratives were used to think through the eyewitness testimonies of how did roofs go? When did roofs go? When did walls go? And so these ingrained systems that qualify who is an expert are preventing the people who have important eyewitness testimony from contributing to these conversations in very real and practical ways that can aid in disaster relief and mitigation and contribute quite a bit to these larger conversations are about what are we as a people going to do when our planet is on fire. So that's kind of a large takeaway from the book. And I just want to move for a moment into some of the stories that we share in this book and the ways that some of these ideas are on display in very individual and community level ways. If we look at Laurel Cubano Santiago, who is in the La Perla neighborhood of San Juan, we see that her neighborhood is so close to the ports that she can sit on her own porch and watch the supply ships come into San Juan. But what happens is that someone meeting the ship says, I decree where the supplies should go. And that means that the supplies don't always get or often don't get into the hands of community members who are in desperate need and who are often in lower socioeconomic communities. And so Laurel and other members of her community through the Pearl Arte Space, which is a mutual aid organization that she founded, come together to feed the community, come together to take care of the elders, start a brigada to knock on doors and say, who is here? What are the needs? What are the community needs? Nilda Rodriguez Collazo is a woman who in her time had a great love of singing and dancing and talks to us about going to some very magical nightclubs in the heyday of San Juan nightclub community. And she talks about how later in life she realized that her life's mission is to care for a niece who is bedridden, Nereida. And Nilda does this beautiful work of taking care of her niece. And a lot of her story is about that until the day after the hurricane, when everyone in her community thought that they had been spared disaster. Her neighbor Tito starts banging on her window and crying, Nilda, Nilda, open the door. The water is at my back. And so there's a storm surge coming behind him, and he rushes inside to carry Nereida upstairs out of her hospital bed and up the stairs to safety. And then it turns out that Nilda is the only person in this neighborhood with a two-story home. And she goes out in her 70s with her neighbor Tito once Nereida is safe upstairs, and they gather the entire community into her second story. And so these are the stories that are missing, these individual, personal, and community stories about how did people, when there was no help coming, how did people gather together to care for each other? And what does that mean? What does that mean that all of this experiential knowledge, if we don't preserve it, if we don't circulate it, if we don't amplify it, it will be lost. And we're not at a time in our global community in which we can afford to lose any knowledge that will help us mitigate the climate crisis and think about how are we building scientific projects and government policies with community-based data sets.
Wow. I mean, extraordinary stories in this collection. And thank you so much for walking us through. Sarah, I wonder if you can just tell us a bit about your contribution to this work.
Of course. Well, I'd like to start by connecting to what Risha just mentioned. And I'm going to borrow this from Laurel, who said it so eloquently once. She called it assessing community strength. Mm-hmm. And to her, that was one of the biggest lessons after the hurricane. The other one I would add would be keeping in mind or listing community needs. At this moment we are living, we are at a point, at a juncture where we cannot afford to be disconnected from one another. And I know today, my experience of being trapped inside my house with black water for over 16 hours would have been an entirely different story had I not been at the time that person who simply left in the morning, came back in the afternoon, and locked herself in her house. Had I that day communicated with my neighbors, let them know that we had moved our cars to another location, fearing debris, then they would have known we were in the home. In other words, we might have been, I guess, safe from that huge flooding and that terrible experience that we went through. So that's certainly, I believe, one of the contributions at large from the stories. Particularly to my case, I am the type of person who uses language and writing in itself. I am an educator and a writer by training. So even before being involved in the Mi Maria project with Risha, with Marcy, and the other narrators, I had already published as recent, I would say, as 2 weeks after the hurricane, I had already gotten a piece in the Huffington Post, which, much like Risha, I think about it now and I say, oh my goodness, how did I even have the courage to do that at that time? Like the tenacity to keep waiting for electricity and driving around when there was no gas to try and find a hotspot. But it was through the word that I felt I could contribute. And this comes back to your contribution might not be monetary. Your contribution might be about advocacy. It might be about using your voice, about using any talent you may have. We had people whose talent was working with children in some of the other narrator stories, like Wendy. And Wendy came in and she just did free childcare for the community members so they could go to work and they could help with the restoration while being sure that their children were safe. Now, beyond what happened right after the hurricane, in the long run, I did also become the curriculum specialist for this particular book, Mi Maria. And that meant having the honor of creating a curriculum for Puerto Rico and a curriculum for the United States, as well as a curriculum that could be used worldwide. I am thrilled to say we have some answers we didn't have as educators in 2017, when, much like Risha explained in the very beginning, many educators went into a classroom after a trauma, after a natural disaster, and they had no idea how to carry out their lessons business as usual. It was impossible for them to do, and they had a scarcity of resources. With this particular curriculum, which is already available through the Voice of Witness website, uses trauma-informed teaching as well as social-emotional learning. So we know ways in which we can incorporate the entirety of this trauma, the experience, and the human itself that is in front of us in the learning process. So I am honored to be part of that contribution at this point. And I do want to tell those educators who are listening that the curriculum is not just about surviving hurricanes or about the Caribbean or about Maria. The curriculum has much larger or macro themes that you can use in your classroom. We look at the concept of globalization and dependency. We also look at representation in cultures and for different groups. And finally, we cover topics such as climate change and colonialism, which I am certain will be relevant to many classrooms worldwide.
No doubt, no doubt. Well, let's go ahead and leave it there. Risha Chansky is co-editor of Mi Maria, Surviving the Storm. Syra Avello-Alisea is one of the book's narrators. As Syra mentioned, it's available now from Haymarket. Lesson plans are also available on the Voice of Witness website. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen. Always a pleasure, Risha.
Now it's time for Tough Questions, our weekly segment where we put tricky questions about free expression to our CEO, Suzanne Nossel. She joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
Suzanne, so, you know, this week we had our annual gala celebration here in New York City, and it was in person for the first time in over 2 years. We talked about some of our honorees the other week on the podcast, but I was hoping you could say why we felt it was so important to gather together and honor writers and courageous free speech advocates.
Sure. You know, this is a beloved event that we've put on for many years. It's a big gathering of writers, readers, their allies, PEN America supporters, and it really sort of energizes our whole advocacy agenda and community in ways that we've always felt sort of last year round. And so we knew we wanted to get back together in person as soon as we could. It was a question about when that would be viable. We started looking at it seriously back in the spring, and we saw, you know, COVID rates were declining, and New York was ahead of the curve nationally in a positive way. Of course, then there was a setback over the summer. You know, we had decided we were going to try to be in person. When the Delta variant surged, we knew that was a question mark, and we had to watch very closely as the data unfolded day by day to see, you know, where the pandemic was. But then we, you know, we really came to feel within the last few weeks that it was possible to get together. And if it was possible to get together safely, we felt it was the right thing. And we had COVID protocols. We required vaccine. We required a COVID test within 72 hours for everybody who attended. And so we felt like with those precautions and masking when you're not eating and drinking, that we could get together in person. I think it paid off in the sense that people felt great about being out together. People saw folks they hadn't connected with in 18 months or more. And I feel for our campaign on behalf of our Iranian writers who are honoring this year, all of our work, that having this energized, kind of almost electrified from the other night constituency is really essential for us. You know, writers also, Ayad made this point that writers play a role in helping the collective society process trauma. And they do that, you know, mostly through the written word, but part of what nurtures the writing community are in-person gatherings, whether it's small readings, writers groups, book groups, and big scale connections as well through things like our PEN World Voices Festival, our literary awards, and the gala. And so nurturing the community in that way, creating these opportunities to get together, we see as part of our role at PEN America, and we were glad to be able to do that this year.
Yeah. Well, Suzanne, let's switch gears a bit. to higher ed. Meantime, this week, a University of Chicago professor who criticized some diversity initiatives on college campuses was scheduled to give a talk at MIT. It was canceled. It appeared to follow a pressure campaign from people who were criticizing his views. I know we often criticize universities for overruling invitations, university administration overruling a department or a student group. Is it different that in this case, just the invitor changed their minds? Is that as egregious?
You know, I think there are some important differences when it's an instance of a university having issued the invitation themselves, as opposed to kind of more common scenario where it's a given department or it's a student group. You know, in this case, it was sort of a prestigious lectureship. And in that instance, what we encourage is that there should be due diligence ahead of time to really understand what the person stands for, what kind of views they're going to propound, and that those decisions should be made with due consideration. Once the decision is made, though, I do find it troubling for the invitation to be rescinded under pressure. Because, look, in this instance, you know, you can read the op-ed that this author wrote, and I've taken a quick look at it. You know, I think it's dismissive of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in a way that, you know, frankly, I don't agree with, and I think, misses the big picture and leaves a lot out. But at the same time, you know, anytime there's a capitulation to a group of people who are protesting, it sets a precedent. And the question I ask is, like, you know, what's the next group that's going to come around and say, you know, we want to deplatform this person. And, you know, maybe that's going to be somebody that I agree with, that I think has said nothing, absolutely nothing wrong. And so I generally think universities need to stick to their guns in these instances. It's one thing where, you know, there's something intervening that has happened. You know, let's say they've got an invitation out and then the person, you know, is arrested for sexual assault. And, you know, all right, so maybe that really is an intervening, intermediate sort of development that justifiably leads to a rethinking of who this person is, what they stand for, what it would mean to bring them onto campus. Those things do happen, but where it's a sort of predating piece of content or an expression of opinion that was out there when the decision is made, I think the notion that that decision can be turned over in the face of protests is a worrying sign for free speech.
Yeah. Well, let's end with our favorite topic, Facebook. Obviously been in the news so much these last few weeks, but this week in particular, dramatic testimony from a whistleblower who had made a bunch of internal documents for clear for both senators and reporters, really sort of, I think, made a very clear case that that the company is monetizing outrage. Facebook, of course, hit back. Mark Zuckerberg himself saying advertisers don't want to appear alongside misinformation or hate speech, and thus profit and more sincere speech motives align. Who's right in this case?
Yeah, I think the whistleblower, Frances Haugert, brought up some really important points, and the research she brought to light, you know, showing us in a very concrete way. I mean, it's not a new argument. You know, if you read the book by the two New York Times reporters, Cecilia Kang and Shira Frankel, you know, they make this case that there's a kind of imperviousness at work at Facebook, and that, you know, time and again, people, whether inside the company or outside the company, have raised deep concerns about the repercussions of the way that the platform is run, the kind of harms that seem to spew off the platform, and yet those in positions of authority there, you know, and ultimately Mark Zuckerberg kind of consistently seems to sort of weigh it up, make a public apology, but then say, you know, ultimately we're going to kind of go ahead with the way that we do things. We won't fundamentally alter it. We'll try to screen out that which is problematic, to be more aggressive in moderating it. But this fundamental algorithmic logic that amplifies is engagement-based. And it's not that it singles out, you know, the outrageous or incendiary. It doesn't do that. It just it is a byproduct of being based off of that which we as human beings engage with the most, that which is most compelling to us. You know, it turns out a lot of the time, and for a lot of us, you know, it's some pretty negative, nasty stuff. So it sort of almost takes that human impulse and, you know, through the work of the algorithm, just reinforces and intensifies it. And, you know, it's not true for everybody. I mean, I'm on Facebook and I don't see any of this stuff. I mean, for me, you know, that which is most compelling, you know, is kind of social or something cool that someone's done. And so, you know, I recognize, you know, also when I go around the world and meet with writers, there are places, I mean, I was in the West Bank over the summer, and the writers there told us, you know, Facebook is a primary platform for them to publish because they don't have, you know, all the online outlets that we have here in English. And so they share their poems and their short stories on Facebook, and it's essential for them. So I think, you know, we can't lose sight of the value of the platform. And the question is how to, you know, much more effectively throttle back, you know, that which is truly noxious, pernicious, and, you know, eating away at our society. And, you know, everyone talks about regulation. There's sort of this ostensible consensus about regulation. The truth, of course, is no one knows exactly what that means and what regulations will really get this under control. I think it ultimately comes down to Mark Zuckerberg having to make a different calculus and having to decide that, you know, they're going to sacrifice profit and they're going to dial back this algorithm and reshape it somehow so that, you know, yes, engagement is a factor, but when it comes to, you know, some of this really pernicious content, that the imperative of deplatforming that, de-emphasizing that, negating its velocity through the platform overrides the counter impulse to just let it run free because it's engagement at all costs.
Well, we'll leave it there. PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel, author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, October 8th. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you soon.